Hello.
Who is this?
Do you like scary movies?
Ed? Is that you?
You're making popcorn, aren't you?
I'm not making anything. This is Ed.
I'm not Ed. I'm Steven.
I've already talked with Steven.
I ask again, do you like scary movies? Suspiria, Nosferatu, Friday the 13th.
Okay, I saw Friday the 13th Part 3 in 3D. But we're supposed to introduce this week's LBC finalist.
We? Don't you mean you? I mean, do you like scary books?
Ed, you're not scaring me. But maybe you're scared.
You're right. I'm scared of my long-distance bill.
Sorry about that, Carolyn. I've got to go. I've almost used up all of my minutes.
Okay, well, there goes Ed. Coming up, we have Scott, Mackenzie, and he's got a better phone plan than Ed does. This is Pinky, and I'm here with Scott from Slushpile.net. And you nominated Demon Theory for the LBC pick.
Yes.
Well, tell me a little bit about how you came across the book, and then we'll talk some more about it.
Well, I came across it because I'm a big fan of McAdam Cage, the publishing company. And pretty much if their name's on something, I feel like I'm going to enjoy it. And then I had also reviewed some of Stephen Graham Jones, the author. I had reviewed some of his other works. So I was pretty familiar with his work, and I knew that Demon Theory was coming out. So I had an early copy of it.
What do you like about Demon Theory?
I thought it was extremely challenging, and I thought that it was really ambitious. And really, I guess maybe to back up a little bit, I kind of struggled with making my selection for the Read This nominee. And I ultimately kind of decided on that I wanted to look at three components. I wanted to look at the publisher and the author, and then obviously the book itself. And as I've said, I just really felt like McAdam Cage does things the right way, and I wanted to kind of give them whatever sort of tip of the cap I could. And then with the author, as far as that's concerned, Stephen Graham Jones he's written all these critically acclaimed books, he's won all kinds of awards, he's extremely prolific, but probably what I thought was kind of the coolest thing about him is just how accessible he is. And I'm quite convinced that someone could catch him in the frozen food section at a grocery store and talk to him about Faulkner for 3 hours, and he would be perfectly happy to do so. So I really kind of felt like, in terms of having someone who is dedicated to literature and just really wants to make a difference in both the lives of writers and readers, I felt like Stephen was deserving of some notice. And then the book itself, Demon Theory, as I say, I thought was really ambitious, and it was challenging, and it was different, and it was kind of funny. And in this weird way, it created this world where even maybe the mistakes made sense. So I just really felt like it was an interesting book that deserved some discussion.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun with it. Since people will hear you before they hear the interview with Stephen Graham Jones, tell us a little bit about the book. Give us a little background.
Okay. It is very kind of complicated to describe, but it is a novelization, a three-part novelization of a feature film trilogy that was based on an unauthorized bestseller taken from the case notes of a fictional doctor at a mental hospital. And it's like reading scripts for the first three Friday the 13th movies, or the Nightmare on Elm Street movies.
So if the movies really existed, they'd be horror movies.
Right. And then the other kind of trademark, or the sort of defining characteristic of Demon Theory, are the footnotes. And those go on for pages and pages, and there are footnotes to the footnotes to the footnotes, and that takes the book in kind of a different direction than just the horror movies. A lot of times the footnotes kind of serve almost as comic relief to maybe the more frightening aspects of the story.
which are and at times truly gory, but in kind of a, you know, a good horror movie kind of a way.
Yeah, I'm not that big of a horror buff, but I kind of I don't know if Jones intended this or not, but I think he kind of created himself, he gave himself the ultimate alibi, in that when we watch these movies, we kind of buy in to whatever they tell us. I mean, it's part of the ticket price that if you're going to watch a Friday the 13th movie, you just say, oh yeah, okay, so the guy can get shot in the head 48 times and still be alive. Okay. Or, sure, I agree that lightning can strike a grave and resuscitate the killer. You know, you kind of go along with it. And in Demon Theory, there's this world created of these horror movies, and so even some of the things that you initially kind of say, come on, then I immediately kind of caught myself and said, well, I'll go with it. I'll go along with it. So when a character gets hanged with a phone cord, my first thought is, that's a little bit much. But then, like I said, that's kind of part of these horror movies, and that's kind of part of your pact that you enter into when you watch these movies. And so then I said, well, yeah, let's go with it.
Thank you so much. And the book was a great, fun selection, and I appreciate having, you know, the flavors of these three books this round were just, each one was so unique. It was really great. Let's just get started. I'm here with Stephen Graham Jones. Do you use all three names?
Yeah, I do.
Who's the author of Demon Theory, which is a novel that's extraordinarily complicated in structure. And so let me see if I've got this right. It's a novel with a whole bunch of footnotes based on a fictional movie trilogy, based on a non-existent academic paper, based on notes from an interview that never happened.
Yep. Yeah. I think there's a couple more layers in there, but yeah, that's pretty much it.
So in approaching this, sort of where did you start? What piece of this was the genesis of the book?
Well, I started writing this in 1999, I guess. It was right on the tail of my first novel, The Fast Red Road, and I wanted to write something that was as opposite as I could of a literary novel. And, you know, I've been a long-time fan of horror, and I thought, let's do some horror. And for me, horror has always been very cinematic, and so the diction, I guess, the screenplay stuff going on in there just kind of fell into place real easy. As to where the layers came from, I don't recall specifically when that happened. It was real early, though. It was before I was even through part one that the layers started happening.
And it's in three parts, so it follows the form of sort of three movies or a movie trilogy. So each part has its own sort of beginning, middle, and end, and really high body count and lots of blood. When you started, did you conceive of it as the trilogy in whole, or did it kind of unfold like many movie sequels do? Like the first one just worked.
Yeah, that's exactly how it happened. I didn't expect to write three of these. I thought it was just going to be a little novella, but then I got to the end of Demon Theory 16 and it wasn't finished. I saw all these ways it was trying to open up, so I just let it.
And if you started it in 1999, I was going to ask you about sort of the time setting, because there's like there's a couple of hallmarks of things that seem to be sort of pre-2000, like VCRs instead of DVDs. REM playing on the radio. Have you set it aside and come back to it?
It never really got set aside, but I have kept it going for, I mean, I wrote it from 1999 till, I guess, 2005 or so. I mean, I finished the main part of it in Thanksgiving of 1999, I guess. But, all the VCR stuff and the REM, I tried to, everything that's going on in the top text and the main story and the novelization is, I think hardly any of it goes past Scream, which was 96. And the footnotes, they of course go up to 2006, but I wanted there to be a break like that, yeah.
Would you say that Like, is there a heyday for horror films that this is that the top text is playing off of?
Oh yeah, there's a heyday for the slasher. Anyways, I'd say starts in 81 with, it starts with Friday the 13th and goes up through about 86 or 87, I guess. And the slasher goes quiet for a while until Scream kickstarts it again, and we get a brief little slasher revival, which we're kind of on the tail end of right now, I think. You know.
So the top text, let's just start with that, is really, yeah, like, it's breakneck. Like, mm-hmm, and I don't mean that literally. Mm-hmm. It just reads really, really fast. And mm-hmm, it probably reads faster than a movie moves in some places.
Mm-hmm.
For you, in writing that, is that the process of just, do you write that fast as it comes out, or is that the process of editing?
No, it pretty much comes that fast. My other stuff, to me, reads just as fast, but that's because, of course, it's in my voice, and I know my voice pretty well. But, using the screenplay terminology, I think you know, that's supposed to be a page a minute, and I was trying to keep to that with Demon Theory, so the pages would turn, like, at movie speed, you know?
And
if you're not reading the footnotes, it would turn at that speed anyways, you know?
Did the top text and the footnotes sort of evolve together? Like, I think about the reader experience and the writer experience have to be really different, because I would get to the footnotes, and I would go off on the footnote tangent, and then I'd be like, oh, wait, come back to the text.
Yeah. Yeah.
As a writer, how did that play out?
It started out, I just discovered that footnote function in my Microsoft Word, I guess. And I was writing Demon Theory and having a ball with the screenplay terminology and all that. But then, maybe, I guess, 15 pages into it, if that, I started dropping footnotes. And they were meant to be deleted later. I was dropping them like, I was calling myself names like, you know, you obviously stole this from Halloween. You stole this from here, you know. But then they just kept snowballing until everything was stolen from something. And that kind of just became one of Demon Theory's conceits, I guess.
It seems like a conceit that you had a lot of fun with.
Mm-hmm.
Is it something that you want to continue, or is it just native to this this work?
No, I don't think I'll ever do the footnote thing again. The screenplay terminology, I kind of doubt if I'll do that again, too. It's not that I don't like it. It's just I like to do new things.
And with the screenplay terminology, how much of this story played out in your head like a screenplay? Were you translating what was visually in your head, or were you...
Yeah, I think that's the way I do all my writing. It's just how far I translate it. And Demon Theory is less translated than my other stuff. Because everything is... All the stories I tell are just running movies in my head.
So the top text story is complicated in that it seems fairly straightforward in the first third, mm-hmm, of the book. Mm-hmm. But then in the middle third, many of the characters that have been in the first third show up, but they're in entirely different roles.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the third, the last third sort of reconciles those two stories.
Mm-hmm.
Is that fair to say?
Yeah, oh, that's the way I intended it, yes. Yeah, so I'm glad you're reading it that way. If author intent, you know, matters and all that. But, the phenomenon I always see in horror movies and slashers particularly is if the first, like you were saying, catches on, you know, and grabs the audience's imagination, then the writers have to scramble and they have to make up a part two and probably a part three. And that's what I was trying to kind of pretend I was doing with Demon Theory, that the first one hadn't been built to contain two sequels to it. And so the second and the third had to just radically re-envision stuff and able to extract enough story from that initial setup, which had to be kind of random. You know, like all the horror movies that didn't plan to be slasher didn't plan to have sequels are kind of random, you know, and the writers who come up with a sequel and the sequel of the sequel have to be really creative and close readers, I think. And so there is a big shift, a really big step you take between Demon Theory 16 and Demon Theory 17, but for me that's just the difference in an original that didn't plan to have a sequel.
And what I think is really neat is that between the covers of a book, we're sort of trained to expect a narrative that is contiguous, that mm-hmm. holds together, and you get to play with that by using sort of hackneyed Hollywood people who just want to make a buck off, you know, a slasher movie that caught on.
Yeah.
And then you get to change that into sort of like a narrative rewriting. At one point in one of your footnotes, you mentioned Umberto Eco and The Name of the Rose and mm-hmm. Palimpsest.
Yeah.
About the rewrite, the writing over, and you end up doing that within this book as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I made that Eco footnote. I kind of made that stuff up, some of that stuff, but it was real fun for me making up facts, making up etymologies and all that. I think I'd been playing. Have you ever played that game Balderdash, where you have to make up definitions for crazy sounding words?
Yeah.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun with that. That's really fun to me.
It also seems like there's, so many of the footnotes are referencing films, and maybe I just missed it, but it seemed like most of your film references were not made up.
Yeah. You gotta be straight on the films, or else people will call you on it. They think you're making a mistake. You know, you have to make up the stuff that they don't know anyways, and are too lazy to look up. You know?
Yeah, I thought it was funny that palimpsest and incest were. I'm like, yeah. I'm not sure if that actually is true.
Yeah.
Did you actually fact check any of the movie stuff, or is it just so set in your head that you didn't need to bother?
The first few times through, I'd kind of thumbnail the years because I kind of knew when they happened. Right before we went to print, maybe I'd say 6 days before we went to print. Well, I had a friend who's real good with this kind of stuff. Fact checked the whole thing for me, and he just found it was littered with mistakes. I'd got all my years like 1 year off. I had Scream happening in 1997 instead of 1996, and just stuff like that. I had Top Gun in the wrong year, which is pretty unforgivable.
That's entirely forgivable.
And also, of course, McAdam Cage, they have their proofreaders and stuff, but they were more interested in the grammar and all that, you know, the movies they kind of trusted me on. And I'm glad I had my friend who was able to do that for me.
Has there been, obviously you've seen a lot of horror films and slasher films. Mm-hmm. Was writing that kind of violence, was that disturbing at all?
No, to me, slashers aren't disturbing. Slashers are the comedy genre of horror. You know, they're safe. The slashers are they're these overdrawn cartoon characters, and you don't have to take them seriously. You know, it's the Emily Roses and The Exorcist. Those just in the Session Nines. Those are terrifying to me. I can only watch them once. You know, but no, slashers in writing slashers, it's not that scary. I'm not saying Demon Theory wasn't scary. Like Demon Theory, there's, you know, three parts, 16, 17, and 18. 16, to me, I modeled on the slasher, and 17, I modeled more on the monster movie, and then 18 is more of a haunted house thing. So as we moved into part 3, that kind of got me, you know, looking to the sky and being kind of scared. But,
yes,
because, you know, demons scare me, but slashers don't really scare me, you know.
Okay. I know that I opened up the book to start reading while I was trying to eat dinner, and it opens with, like, a disembodied arm.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, I'm not going to read this while I'm eating.
Yeah. I can't watch... go on.
No, please go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I can't watch South Park or Funny Stone Videos or anything while I'm eating, because they're always showing babies spitting up, or, you know, South Park has all kinds of gross stuff. I can't. I'm like that, too.
I don't want to get too much into the text of what happens in the in the top story in the end, because I feel like the puzzle of what's happening is one of the driving forces of the plot of the book overall.
Yeah, that's exactly what I wanted. Yeah.
So I don't want to sort of give away too much.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
But in the beginning, you're really playing with those. The iconographies of horror film. Like, there's one character who basically shows, like, the hot girl who's only wearing a bra.
Yeah.
But then you get to take those characters and sort of remake them in the later versions. And but it sets up, like, an ensemble cast. Like, nobody's really... There's maybe two people who sort of emerge as the narrator. So in novel form... What would you say, who are the narrators? What is the narrative point of view? And does it change from, you know, 16 to 17 to 18?
Yeah, it does. It does change. I would call Hale the, I call Hale the narrator of part 16. Part 17, yeah, that's more of an ensemble trick, isn't it? I think 17 and 18, I would both ascribe to the second narrator, you know?
Okay. Your names are very, it's not Jenny and Bob and Dave. Like you said, there's Hale, which sounds a little bit like hell. And there's Khan, and I'm wondering, and I'm not even sure if I'm pronouncing that right, because maybe it's Khan.
Yeah, no. Yeah, that's how I say it, yeah.
Where did the names come from, and did you want people to be sort of saying them aloud and getting different meanings?
I guess I do in all my fiction. I try to come up with character names that'll stick, you know, the Freds and the Georges and the Bobs and the Stevens are pretty boring to me, so I try to hit the names that, if you see them on a wall, you'll remember them. One thing I kept catching heat on from everybody with Nona was her name is Nona, but people call her Known, N-O-A-N, and people kept saying it was a typo, it was a misspell, and so finally I had to reduce it to just Khan. He's the only one who calls her Known, and hopefully that didn't look like a typo to you, but got a lot of grief for that. And Khan, of course, Conan's my favorite, you know, character ever, so I just wanted to do a little, show a little respect there, you know.
I am probably more familiar with horror films than I should be.
You don't have to be guilty for horror films, I don't think.
But I'm less familiar with sort of horror as a genre of novels and literature.
Yeah.
And I thought it was interesting how you engaged so much with horror films, but less so with sort of the novelistic history of horror. And I was wondering if you could talk about that a little bit.
As many footnotes as there are, if I would have allowed myself to go down the horror literature road, then I would have, the footnotes would have, there would have been twice as many easily, and then it would have really impeded the text, I think, impeded the story. It would have become a lot more of an academic thing than I intended. I intend the movie footnotes to be kind of like just a running joke, you know, but if you start really citing books, then it becomes a lot more serious, I think. And of course, I don't like to be too serious at all, you know.
But do you read those books?
Oh yeah, I inhale them. I just read one 2 days ago, I guess. Yeah.
I wanted to see if you would be interested in talking at all about playing with sort of narrative and etymology, and like early on, you talk about the book Urban Legend, which. There's a movie that comes out that's called Urban Legend that's based on a book that didn't exist, but then somebody ended up making the book.
that's so beautiful. I love that.
you're playing with that a lot, with having sort of the various versions of narrative, like origin texts for demon theory, when there really is no origin text other than the book. Yeah. Would you want to see this get turned into a film, or did you ever try doing like a screenplay version of any of the stories that are within it?
I think that's probably what Demon Theory came out of, was I kind of wanted to write a horror movie, but screenplays to me are just so difficult. You have to do everything in dialogue, and that's just so constraining to someone used to prose fiction, you know. And so the best way I could do it was to suck all that screenplay stuff into you know, a prose narrative. But yeah, it'd be a blast to see it on screen, you know. I think it might really work well as a graphic novel, but it might just be a really long graphic novel too. I don't know.
would you want to include footnotes in a graphic novel?
No, I don't think I would. Yeah. I think in the movie, if it ever made it to a movie, and then if it somehow migrated back to a DVD, then it'd be fun to do one of those what's the name, Infinifilm or whatever, or kind of like a pop-up video version with the footnotes, you know, kind of melting onto the screen as it happens. It'd be kind of fun.
Oh my god, I can just see it. Do they still do pop-up video?
I just recorded like about 40 of them the other day. they're not doing it though. It's all old stuff, but it's still around anyways.
So it feels to me like there's sort of, you said that you know your own voice very well, and so you don't have to do a lot of editing.
No, I do a whole lot of editing. Yeah, just on everything. I like to say edit as I go, but lots of people say they edit as they go, but it's hard to really and truly edit until you can see the full shape of the thing. Then you have to go back and just cut out everything that's unnecessary. And with Demon Theory, of course, I burned through the first draft in, I think, 10 months. And then you know, massaged it for 5 years, I guess, and tried to get everything perfect. Like in the very last paragraph of Demon Theory, there's I think to me a very important line, which didn't even come to me until like, you know, 3 days before it was going under that print wheel, you know.
You're really kidding.
Yeah, it really blows me away. I mean, it blows me away that I'd be a stupid enough writer not to see this obvious thing that needs to happen, you know.
But we can't talk about it because it's in the last line.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's almost in the last line. Yeah.
Well, it feels like... Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go on. I was probably just going to give it away. I better not.
No, you can't.
I was just going to say what I substituted... I substituted Death Machine for Three Wheeler, which I thought was really important.
Yeah, well, I liked that.
Yeah, but for me, that this isn't your question, but for me, Demon Theory is it's a very, very autobiographical novel, even though the stuff that happens is, you know, way off the reality scale or whatever. Because that Three Wheeler wreck that's at the center of Demon Theory is something that happened to me when I was like, I don't know, 10 or 12 years old. You know, I grew up in the cotton fields up in West Texas. And when you're 10 or 12, you just get a three-wheeler and, you know, your parents turn you loose and don't see you until you're 15. And I was out there with my cousin riding one day, and it must have been fall because the cotton was pretty tall. You know, it was about up to the thigh. And I was in the back of her three-wheeler. Mine had broke down way far away. And we're just slamming down the road. We had to go real fast because we were going through somebody else's field, and they'll just get all over you if you tear up their cotton. And sure enough, my foot did that thing that Jenny's foot does and got sucked under the wheel and pulled me down between the peg and the tire, you know, just tore me all to pieces. And then I managed to, and my cousin circled around, came back and picked me up and got me on the back of the three-wheeler, and she's trying to get me to home so I can get all bandaged up. And sure enough, it happens again. I get sucked under again, and I come back.
God.
I know, I come up even more bloody, and I've got tire tracks on my face. It was really an ugly scene. And my shoes were gone by that time. My shirt was all in rags. And she was all worried, but I said, I was trying to get her to take me home. I couldn't really talk all that well. And so we get on again, and it happens the third time. It was the most ridiculous thing. And that's where the structure of Demon Theory comes from, is that felt like I was dying three times there, you know? Because every time I stood up, I thought, well, this is it. I'm dead, you know. Somehow
wow.
I kept being alive. I don't know.
Are you pulling my leg?
No, it's true. It's true.
And so for people who haven't read the book yet, at the sort of center of each of the three parts of Demon Theory, there's a three-wheeler accident with a brother and his sister. And then it follows, but it's actually set in, like, mostly with 20-somethings, like classic
yeah.
horror.
Yeah,
early
20-somethings. Yeah, it's got to be because there's adult themes, you know.
You got to have the girl in the bra.
Exactly.
Wow, that's crazy. Did your cousin get in big trouble?
No, she just dropped me off. We lived in houses right beside each other, way out in the middle of cotton fields, and she just dropped me off my door. And I remember she sat there on her three-wheeler idling, waiting until I made it in the door, and then she just pulled away. And my mom bandaged me up and everything. And I was all right. We went and got my three-wheeler a day or two later, I guess.
Did you ever get back on it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I had so many. I had a lot more terrible wrecks than that. But yeah, that was the one that informed the novel, anyways.
Can you talk a little bit about your evolution as a writer? Because I don't know the story. How'd you end up going from being like a beat-up kid on a three-wheeler in a cotton field to being a multi-published novelist?
Yeah, I never planned to go in college. My plan, all through high school, I mean, I only went through like 3 years of high school, I guess, was to, I wanted to get a tractor on a lease and get a trailer out in the middle of the cotton field and become a custom farmer. You know, that's just somebody who, like, has tractor, will plow. You know, you don't have your own fields, you just plow other people's fields. And that was my plan. That was gonna bring happiness, you know, that's what I've been planning on forever. But then, I remember a girl I was wanting to date at the time, and this was when I should have been a senior, I guess. She needed a ride to the SATs, and she had called me a couple weeks before or something for this ride, and I took her. And then, because I thought it would be rude not to, I went ahead and took the ACTs too, and kind of did pretty good on them, just because school has always been ridiculously easy. And then my mom got those test scores, and she gave them to a college where my brother, the one college that my older brother was, my, the college my brother was going to, and And I got accepted, and she said she'd pay for my first year if I went. And I went and got hooked and paid for the rest of it myself, became a philosophy major, and never went back to farming. I mean, I'd go back in the summers and farm, but never went back to it. As for writing, I guess in high school I was doing a lot of writing, but it was all these long, complicated apology letters to girlfriends, you know. I'd leave them on their under their windshield wipers, and they'd usually get me back in the door, you know. So that's where I learned my craft, I guess. That's the most pure form.
Writing is persuasion.
Exactly, exactly. And I guess it was my freshman year for some essay in composition, maybe. I just decided to. No, I know what happened. Yeah, I remember what happened. I was in lit class. That's what it was. I was in world lit, and the cops came and pulled me out. Took me to the emergency room because one of my uncles was about to die. He'd been burned really, really bad, and I was the only person in town. So I had to sit there for 3 days, and because they pulled me out of lit class, I had an empty notebook with me and a pen, and so I had nothing to do those 3 days, so I just wrote a story, and I gave it to my English teacher, and she gave it to the creative writing faculty, and they kind of lured me into creative writing, and I sort of won an award and just been with it ever since. After I got my BA in philosophy and English, I applied to two schools, one for creative writing and one for philosophy. I didn't know which way I was going to go. But then English got back to me first, so I went to English and started getting published as a master's student, and then went to Florida State and slammed through a PhD in 2 years, I guess.
Oh, my God.
And wound up getting my dissertation published. But then after that, I didn't plan on being a professor. It was never my plan at all. I came back to Lubbock, Texas. I was working on the dock at Sears because I just always, ever since I got out of farming, I've just been doing warehouse work because it just always feels natural to me. I just like to get up early and work. But sure enough, I was moving a refrigerator or something one day, and I just blasted my back out. And so as soon as I could walk again, I went to the classifieds and to find a desk job. And the desk job I found was on Texas Tech campus, and then I got on campus for a year and got to talking to the creative writing faculty, and they had a job open up, and I picked it up and kept publishing novels.
I read an interview that you did where you said that you occasionally your undergraduates outright you. You show
them
stuff that you were writing back then. And so have you seen, like, where do you see your writing going next if you've seen it change over time?
Yeah, well, I mean, those undergraduates outright me. I mean, yeah, number one, they outright me. As when I was 19 and they're 19, they're just blowing me away. But what's really terrifying is, you know, I give them my own stories, and that I'm writing, like, right now when I'm 34, and sometimes they'll still outright me, you know. That just terribly intimidates me because I think, dang, you know, I've got all this education and experience under my belt, and they can still just look into this perfect little story. But as to where I'm going, I just started another novel yesterday, I guess. I think I need to be done by March 1st, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, kind of, Jesus.
And I've got, like, a lot of reading schedules. I don't know. I have, like, no free weekends, but I'm going to have to find time somehow to do it.
So are you doing readings for Demon Theory?
Yeah, I guess. Well, it's just, like, universities call and say, hey, come read, and I go read, you know, and it's a blast.
Are you going to, where are you headed?
I'm Colorado, Boulder, Colorado, I think it is, Atlanta, Georgia.
So you're going to be at AWP?
No, I'm thinking I'm reading there right before AWP. I think I'm skipping AWP just so I can have some rest, you know? Actually, you know, I skipped AWP back in 90, well, I've only been to two AWPs ever, but when I was at Florida State in 96, I guess, maybe 97, I was all lined up to go to AWP. They had a big caravan going, and at the last minute, I backed out and started writing my first novel instead, and that's what I'll be doing this time. I'll be backing out of AWP so I can write a novel.
Yeah, it's probably the smart thing to do.
Yeah, lots of debauchery at AWP, you know, lots of chances to get in trouble.
Oh, well, then I will go. So do you enjoy the reading process? And do you ever, like, if you're reading from Demon Theory, do you ever, like, find yourself jumping around because of your adult content?
Actually, the last few readings I've done, I bring Demon Theory, but I read other stuff. I've yet to crack open Demon Theory and read any words. Kind of terrified to do that. I don't know why. Maybe I'll do that one of these readings. I don't know. I just have lots of little, you know, short pieces, you know, 6-8 pages, first person, all one scene, which work pretty well out loud.
Are those autobiographical or are they fiction?
Well, I mean...
And is there a difference?
Yeah, that's just a question. Yeah, they're mostly fiction. I guess one of them, I think one piece I read lately was a zombie story, and that's, you know, fiction. I'm pretty sure.
We hope. Demon Theory to me feels like it's got two different voices, the top story and the footnotes.
Oh, that's really perceptive because up until about, I'd say 2 weeks before it went to press, that's what was going on. It was Demon Theory by Stephen Graham Jones, edited by Lindsay Ballard. And she was this kind of, I don't know what the word is, she didn't like me. This is a hit. And she's always sniping at me and correcting my stupid comments and saying I obviously didn't know what I was talking about. At the very end, I decided that was too Johnny Trent. Like, you know, people might think I was riffing on Daniel Lewski or something. So I went and ripped it all out. But some of her syntax, which is, you know, kind of snipey, will remain, I think, or does remain.
There was, at one point, you mentioned, like, double lives and refraction and science. And yeah. I happen to be reading Against the Day, which is Thomas Pynchon. And I just read Scarlett Thomas's The End of Mr. Y.
Uh-huh.
And it seems like everybody's kind of talking about, like, this kind of science thing.
Yeah, it's the zeitgeist. I remember I put that in Demon Theory as kind of a little, I guess, in my first novel, The Fast Red Road, I played with that quantum, that weirdness of the quantum mechanics that, you know, a particle can be in two places at once, and I've kind of made a particle be a person, so you got two people in two places at once, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, but, you know, Fast Red Road is so complicated that the one thing you don't need is quantum mechanics in that book, you know? So I thought maybe I could put it in Demon Theory, you know? But, yeah, of course, Pynchon, he's doing it. I mean, good grief, everything in that novel splits and branches, you know?
Yeah, well, I don't know because it's taking me forever to finish, but...
Yeah.
I think it's interesting that you're a writer who returned to Texas, and you're in Texas, and there's, like, sort of this, like, there's, like, the publishing community in New York, and you're separate
mm-hmm.
from that, but...
Mm-hmm.
So, in what ways do you define your sort of writerly community, and who are the writers that you look to, or, like, you said Daniel Lewski and Pynchon and... I'm guessing David Foster Wallace.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Who are my heroes, or
a combination. Like, who are your heroes, and like, what's your writing community, and do you ever feel like?
Yeah.
Do you ever feel like I'm only in Pennsylvania, and I feel out of it not being in New York?
Yeah.
Do you ever feel distant?
Yeah,
being in Texas.
I guess you know, I don't go to the cocktail parties where you're supposed to wear all black and all that stuff up in New York. I mean, I've been to them, but they're not that fun, you know? I'm sure if I wanted, I could nab a job up in New York, but New York terrifies me, you know? It's just so big. I'm Lubbock, where I am right now. I don't live in Lubbock. I live in a different town. I teach in Lubbock, but Lubbock was, I think, 200,000 people, and that to me is just ridiculous big. I don't like it at all. So I had to move to a place that has 1,900 people, you know. So I'm very, very, very happy to be isolated. I prefer the isolation. As for my writing community, it's probably pretty small. I have my editor at Fiction Collective. She's a first reader of all my stuff, whether it's going to Fiction Collective or not. She's very helpful. Brenda Mills. Everything goes to her, and she's my best reader, I think. And of course, there's my agent, Kate Yerrick. She reads everything. Who else do I give my stuff to? Let me think. I have usually, you know, I have some friends. I have a friend down in Austin. He's the guy who helped with Demon Theory. He'll help me with stuff. I have a couple of friends here in Lubbock who, I think they're just ex-graduate students, I guess, who I trust a lot to read my stuff. As to who my heroes are, my big hero of all time, of course, is Philip K. Dick, but he's dead as can be, you know, so I don't know if he counts. Vonnegut, man, that guy blows me away every time I read Vonnegut. He intimidates me where I can't hardly write, because he makes these very, very difficult things look so, so easy. One of my all-time heroes, of course, would be John Barth. I think he's the most brilliant writer we've ever had. Stephen King, I think Lissy's story is far and away the book of 2006. It just really, really impressed me. I don't know, I like Christopher Moore. That guy cracks me up a lot. I don't know, maybe that's enough. I can't. I should make a list for interviews so I can just read off a list of who I like, you know?
Well, sometimes it changes, too.
Oh, it does, yeah. Yeah.
I want you to tell me more about the different ways that you, like, Demon Theory as a whole, and, like, mm-hmm. it's got the top story and it's got the footnotes, and we've talked about mm-hmm. them separately, but as a whole, like, I don't want to say what were you trying to do, but I want you to talk about the project with the big picture, like, all the pieces sort of united.
Yeah, yeah, well, I did really, really, you know, punish myself over that, trying to get the footnotes to work with the top text instead of against it. Like, I cut a lot of footnotes, which I thought were pretty, you know, funny and all that, because they would be distracting from the top text too much, which I know, I mean, they all distract, of course, but sometimes I would want a scene to be moving at a certain speed, and I'd realize, and if there's a long footnote embedded in that scene, then it's going to break the scene apart, of course. So I would have to just sacrifice that footnote or try to find a way to shuttle it somewhere else, or something like that. And that was the biggest challenge, I think, for me as a writer with Demon Theory was, I guess the biggest challenge really would be not indulging myself, not putting all my favorite movies and everything in there. Which...
Didn't you put all your favorite movies in there, though?
Yeah, most of them. Yeah. But, like, I'm happy that I was able to pull, like, there's a big, long, wandering Thomas Pynchon footnote. And, I mean... I still kind of miss it. I can see I was looking through Demon Theory the other day, and I could see the hole where it used to be, but I pulled it because I was afraid I was indulging myself. But I was doing it for me when I needed to be, keep in mind that there's a reader on the other end of this book, you know, who needs to be able to follow it too. They're not going to get your personal little list of heroes, you know. They need to matter to the text.
Well, but some of the footnotes that are less relevant to the text are also really funny. Like, I'm trying to find it. The one about the Easter Bunny? Bark, bark.
Oh, yeah. That was hell fine in figuring out when that commercial debuted.
It's on YouTube. Yeah, now it's easy to find. It's on YouTube.
Oh, cool. I wish YouTube had been around and doing this. That's in part, that's early, that's about a third of the way into Demon Theory 16. It's when Egan falls down through the attic into Hale and Jenny's old room. Almost onto that bedpost.
So it's in the middle of somebody saying, "Thank you, Dungeon Master."
Yeah.
Thanks, Easter Bunny. There's one, at one point, one of the footnotes in 18 is for the word gate. Like someone says, a gate was opened.
Yeah.
And then there's like 3 pages of footnotes on the word gate. It kind of cracked me up. In that, like, it really wasn't about that gate at all. It was just like, we got to talk about opening portals in horror films, and it's going to be a really long story.
Yeah, that's exactly what's going on. And if I remember correctly where that happened, I realized sometimes I would reduce the, like in Microsoft, you know, you can reduce in Microsoft Word, you can reduce the zoom down to like 10% so you can see like, you know, 100 pages on the screen or whatever. Mm-hmm. I would look at Demon Theory like that sometimes, so I could see how much I could like track the footnotes up and down, how much of the page they were displacing, and where that gate thing happens, I realized that there was a big hole. You know I was saying earlier that I don't need to interrupt the story in some places because the scene needs to move, but in other places the story needed to be interrupted, I think, and so I would do that.
There's like 2 lines of text and then a huge chunk of footnotes. But since you started writing at the beginning and then ended up like coming up with this like trifold structure, did you find yourself going back and rearranging your first version to make it fit?
No, not much. I really, really tried not to do that specifically because I think that would taint the first version. What I made myself do was act like I was the hired gun writers coming in to fix up this first one and pull 2 stories. Not to fix it up, but to pull 2 stories out of what exists already, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And that's just what I was really trying to do that. I think if I would have allowed myself to go back and change 1 to fit 2 and 3, then I would have also allowed myself to have the characters or the story develop in certain ways to allow certain footnotes when I'm actually, I mean, if I ever did that, I don't remember it anyways. I would only try to ramp the footnotes off stuff that I'd already written that was there for the story, if that makes sense. Nobody would say, you know, go to the gate now just so I could put that footnote in. You know, the footnote had to develop, the footnote had to develop spontaneously out of the, something that's happened in the story that already needed to be there.
So did you write the top story and then do the, footnotes separately? Or was it sort of working on them in tandem?
Yeah, well, I wrote the top story first, and the footnotes were just kind of like I was saying, that little jibing at myself, you know. Why don't you be serious, dude, and all that stuff. I always call myself Steve instead of Steven, and the footnotes were all, you know, Steve, you dillwad, what are you thinking here, and stuff like that. But then I would go and flesh those out, you know, and cut out the Steve, of course. But some of the hostility remained when Lindsay Ballard was there.
Are you ever going to revive Lindsay Ballard, or did you kill her off for good?
Oh, man, I love Lindsay Ballard. She's a, I hope I'm remembering the name right. She's a character from Star Trek Voyager who I just fell in love with. It was such a cool story. She's a crew member that gets, you know, buried in space, but then there's a race of aliens who kind of trail behind, and the way that they repopulate, the way they breed, is they take over dead bodies and bring them back to life, and their consciousness is in that dead body. So their race is all these mixed people, but... And so Lindsay Ballard comes back to the Enterprise, but she's not Lindsay Ballard. She just looks like Lindsay Ballard, and it just really, really fascinates me so much. I doubt if I'll ever... I definitely never revive her in Demon Theory. I don't know if I'll ever use her anywhere else, so probably not.
Can I ask how you would classify Demon Theory? Is it a horror novel?
Yeah, that's definitely what I intend, is for it to be a horror novel. Yeah.
Okay. I don't know your other work, sorry. Is that the genre that you're going to continue working in, or have worked in the past?
Let's see. Since Demon Theory, I've written one horror novel, and I think I've got two other horror novels written besides Demon Theory. But I write just all over the board. Like, I just wrote a novel about a guy working a drive-thru urinal, you know, which is a different kind of horror, I think. But
a guy doing what?
He works at a drive-thru urinal, which kind of makes him sad, you know. So it's kind of a tragedy.
He works at a drive-thru urinal.
Yeah.
This is something you've invented, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I invented it, but I've also I was at Goodwill once, and I hang out at Goodwill and all those shops a lot, and I found a little it looked like a blender, the stuff you put the mix in a blender. Mm-hmm. But the mouth of it was different. It was made for peeing in. It's like a portable urinal, and I just thought, wow, you know, where are we going as a people, you know?
Can you imagine being the guy who gave that to the Goodwill?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't need my pee box anymore. I'll give it to Goodwill.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds like the worst job ever.
Yeah, I think so. And I wrote a novel about a rabbit-headed zombie, which was pretty fun. I write novels just all the time, and I've written a couple of screenplays in the last few months, too.
So it sounds like you write like crazy.
And, yeah, I write all the time, yeah.
And you said you've written screenplays. Was that something that came easier to you after doing sort of the novelized version of the screenplay in Demon Theory?
No. If anything, Demon Theory spoiled me, because it kind of told me that you can tell the story you want to tell in a screenplay, which is a lie, you know. Well, it's not a lie, but it's just so, for me, screenplays are so, so difficult. They're difficult and fun. Like, in a way, if you write a villanelle, that's very difficult, because you get this really strict line order and all this rhyme pattern and all that stuff going on, and that's kind of how I look at a screenplay. You've got all these strictures, and you've got to learn how to contort yourself within that to tell the story. It's very, very hard for me, but maybe that's just because I'm a prose writer first, and when I came to graduate school, the professors had to pound it into me to do dialogue, because I hated doing dialogue. I thought everything could be filtered through the narration. I thought, Tristan Egoff does this in Lord of the Barnyard, and I thought it was brilliant, a 402-page novel with not a single line of dialogue. But by the time I read that, I'd already been broken into habit, so now I'm dependent on dialogue. I suspect it's part of my problem with screenplays is that dialogue doesn't come as naturally to me as it does to some people.
Oh, well, it came across really naturally in Demon Theory.
Oh, thank you.
And what are your screenplays about?
Oh, let's see. The one I just wrote is a zombie story. I really like zombies. A closed door zombie trick. And the other one is a torture story, because I watch all this torture stuff at the movies and everywhere, and you know, 24 everywhere it happens, and I always think that's not how you torture somebody. I always think if I was in a room with somebody and they gave me, you know, this set of instruments to hurt them, then I could really hurt them. You know, I wouldn't hurt them in this movie fashion. And I thought, let's just write a screenplay about that. You know, so it's. But then, but the trick is, you don't when you really want to hurt somebody, you don't do it with scalpels and pliers and all that. You do it to their mind. You know, you torture them psychologically. And I think this all comes from a Kids in the Hall sketch. As stupid as that sounds, there's an old kid in the Hall sketch about this guy on a talk show who specializes in monkey torture, and that cracked me up. Maybe it's on YouTube now. I haven't even looked for it for years. But this guy, the way he tortures his monkey is he always says, "I'm calling the ASPCA. I'm going to let you go." And then he picks up the phone, and it's all a big joke, and the monkey's in agony because he thought he was getting away. You know, oh. It cracked me up.
It seems like you have the capacity to live with nightmarish thoughts, maybe more than other people do.
Yeah, I guess so. It could. I think it's just I do write lots of stuff which could be called horror, I guess.
Or scary. And,
yeah, maybe scary. I think that's just because I'm trying to get out of my head, because I'm a terribly scary person. Like, me getting through the house at night, turning off lights, is such a complicated thing, because I have to turn off this light and then dive for that light and turn it off, and it's so complicated. And I get, I've always got knives and stuff on me, because I'm not terrified that someone's going to pick me out of the sky or come up out of the ground and get me, or there's a werewolf behind my dumpster.
I'm sure there is, actually.
Yeah. I live terrified, and I always try so hard to get that down on paper so I don't have to live terrified anymore, but it never really happens. It just breeds more, you know?
Yeah, the more zombies you get on paper, the more start lurking in the closet.
Yeah. I do always have to block the door when I'm writing, though, because I just, I'll jump out of my skin if all of a sudden somebody walks in the room, you know?
So thanks, and if there's anything else you want to tell people about the book who haven't had a chance to read it yet that we haven't talked about.
Oh, just that the trade paperback's going to have a big, a pretty significant difference, I guess. But and it'll come out in April. So.
Can you tell us, you would give away too much if you told us what
it was? Oh, I guess I can tell you that the footnotes are all going to be endnotes.
Really?
So you can focus on the main story. I want to see how that works. Yeah.
Wow, it would be a different read, I think.
Yeah. Some people I've told say that's... That's good, and some people say that ruins it, you know?
I don't know. I'm pretty compulsive. When there are endnotes, I usually keep my thumb in the back and keep going back and forth.
Yeah, I'd love to. I wish I could talk my publisher into making those little divots in the pages like you have in dictionaries, you know?
So
you
could go back. That'd be awesome.
Yeah, I know. That'd be cool. I don't know what's involved with that.
And so what's the next thing that we're going to see from you? Or is it already out?
No, not yet. I'm not sure. If I can get this novel done by March 1st, then I may have something coming out here in 2008. And, I've got some of my McAdam Cage is looking at something else of mine right now. So who knows which way I'm going to go. I have so many novels right now, I could go any which way, you know, which is always the problem with, if you notice, I've had, like, I guess 5 books and, what, 4 publishers, you know. Usually a novelist or a writer will, you know, find a publisher and kind of stick with them. But editors always want me to maintain a list, and I'm never into writing the same kind of book time and again, you know. I'd really like to do more of what Joe Lansdale does. He says he doesn't have a genre, or if he has a genre, it's just a Joe Lansdale book, you know, and that's what I'd like to do, just to be able to write a zombie story or a monkey story or, you know, a love story, which I wrote one of those recently, which was pretty fun.
And nobody's head gets ripped off? Nobody gets a knife through their head?
I gave myself a set of rules when I was writing this book. I said, this is that Flush Boy one, or the drive-through urinal one. I said, nobody dies, and there's no violence, nothing like that. I wanted to see if I could still tell a story without that, if I was using the violence as a crutch, you know? I just wanted to push myself, and I think it was successful. It was all kinds of fun. You discover all kinds of little facets of story when you don't allow yourself just to cut a character's head off, you know? I think.
You mean when somebody has to leave the room and not end up like yeah. dead or dismembered?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You know, they become real people, you know. It's not to say that people aren't real in Demon Theory, but it's a different kind of real, I think.
Yeah, in some way they're all sacrificial. Like,
yeah.
Well, thanks so much for doing this, and I wish you the best of luck with your readings, and I hope that you find enough time to continue writing before March 1st.
Yep, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks.
Take care.
Bye. So I forgot tiny felony, but the demon